Okay, good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Good to see you. Tonight I'm talking about the Buddha's parinirvana, or the Buddha's death, which we call parinirvana in his case because he had attained nirvana. And then parinirvana is also, we could translate that as nirvana without remainder. So nirvana is this complete release of all karma, complete working through of all karma, complete seeing through all greed, all aversion, so that it no longer arises. Complete seeing through of the false sense that we carry around of a self, a fixed kind of thing. So the Buddha had attained a level of release of all these false constructs, but still there's this remainder, his body. And then the final release, the great unbinding, that final unbinding comes at death. So the Buddha's parinirvana, or the Buddha's death. Nirvana, that term itself, we don't talk about this a lot, but I might talk about it every year. We don't talk about it a lot because this idea I'm going to present is scary maybe, or aversive maybe, but it actually means extinction, or extinguishing, as in extinguishing of a flame. And in the sense that I just spoke of, it is a kind of death. It is a kind of death. And so this gives us a clue into why we might encounter so much fear sometimes in the cushion, on the cushion, especially in retreat, as we release and release and release and hit this point of, oh my gosh, like, there's nothing there. So we continue to clarify this. Clarify this. See what's left as we let go and let go and let go. Stay with the truths we see or start to see. Ask ourselves, was this really what I'm seeing? As I continue to let go of my ideas, as I continue to be with and surrender into my karmic situation. So at the time of death, the instruction at the bedside is to completely release, and that we might have further karma arise in this time of death, and not to be afraid of any of that, any of what might arise, but to continue to let go even in those moments, even in that moment. and to not be afraid of what might appear before us, even if it might be as close as we can get to objectively frightening. Mm-hmm. So some of what can appear at the moment of death is some sort of manifestation of remaining karma. And then what we grasp onto in that moment or those moments, right? There's not like one moment, there's a dying process generally, becomes solidified. So more of a chance that that's going to be carried forward or not resolved. Need to be carried forward into a new life, whether we call that our next life or not. I'm not going to try to figure that out or know that. So yeah, ideally at the moment of death, I'm able to completely release and completely grasp onto nothing. At the moment of my death, I hope to do my best with that. And I also acknowledge that my release might at least somewhat be at the level of releasing judgments I might have about how much holding is still there. Mm-hmm. An acceptance of least of that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we think we're not afraid, and then we are. Or sometimes we think, I don't think I've worked through it all, but maybe we do. Or we at least think we've worked through this thing that's coming up, and oh well, oops, there it is. Huh? Further to go, further to go. Maybe another lifetime or three, or 10. So we do this on the cushion too, in a way in preparation, but seeking to release completely from the grasping activity of the mind, or do our best estimation of that in the moment. So if Buddhahood is attained, we're not reborn. And I want to touch at least a little bit on I think we want to always aim for this complete release. And I think the Mahayana ideal, my clarity about that at this time, offers us an important pointer. And my clarity on this is that the pointer is not that we would be better off holding on to some idea that we're going to be reborn again so that we can help others. But rather, or in part, there is a recognition that what we do, this whole activity of continuing to release, continuing to clarify, we do with and for others. We do it for others. This work cannot be done just for me. So there's this idea out there about a distinction between Theravadan and Mahayana Buddhism, where you know, those Theravadins who are on the lower vehicle, on the not such good path, But if it's not such a good path, why are there so many Theravadan practitioners, right? That makes no sense. But those people over there that don't get it, they're just trying to release it all at the moment of death and attain Buddhahood, and they're doing it all for themselves. But it just can't work that way. It just can't work that way, because what we're releasing is all the self-grasping. And what we're realizing in part is a complete connection and indeed interpenetration with what we would call other in the first place. So we can't release it all just for me. The further point I want to make here is that if we believe we've reached a point of some degree of enlightenment or some degree of seeing the oneness or emptiness of self, the further challenge, it's not like, oh, okay, great, I can just leave now, right? We don't get to leave before it's our time to leave. The further challenge is to be a functional bodhisattva in the world and maintain that understanding. Maintain this broad understanding, maintain our clarity about emptiness of self, maintain our focus outward to the extent that we don't need to worry so much about our neurotic, sometimes overly inwardly focused mind. I think that's the other part of the teaching of arhatship not being a final point. Arhatship we call, I don't know much about the different levels and I don't want to get into that anyway. I don't think it's important, but we call someone an arhat who's, quote, attained nirvana. Okay, so some pretty advanced level of enlightenment, actually. So the seeing through is not there are further steps, and specifically into functioning, into continuing while we still have this human body and this human life, continuing to walk the planet and serve others, even in our dying process, if that's what's next, right? We're there, we show up, right? We have an impact and people benefit from our lives and our clarity and our groundedness. Though imperfect. So this is the reminder that we're already bodhisattvas. So bodhisattva is something we simultaneously already are, and it's this ideal beyond our arhatship. Both at once. We've got to let go of getting there or not getting there, right? If we think we're an arhat, we're probably not an arhat. I think that's why Zen doesn't talk a lot about being an arhat. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Buddha's last meal. This, for me, is another important part of the story of the Buddha's death. So the Buddha ingested something as part of a meal that a donor offered to him and his community, and realized that that food was essentially poison and lethal. And this was not the intention of the donor to kill the Buddha, but that this in fact would kill the Buddha. So one aspect of this for me is imagining the mind state. So if we're to believe that the Buddha is completely free of clinging and aversion, or wanting something to be otherwise, so we have this completely dispassionate, oh, the moment of my death is near. So reminded of that, I can feel into that mind state to the extent that I'm able to access that with my body. Or see if I can. Yeah, something to play around with maybe on the cushion. Can I imagine being aware that I'm going to die and remaining completely present and completely equanimous about that? And to circle back to an earlier point here, completely non-judgmental about my best approximation being quite likely imperfect, or quite possibly imperfect. I think we can really touch real equanimity. And then the other part of this story of the Buddha's last meal, may not have been his last meal, but the one that killed him, is to have the presence of mind to do two things. One is to say, hey, nobody else eat this. Okay. So to have that clarity, but also, to me, this is clearly an example of, you know, sometimes I talk about holding fast and letting go. So we talk about letting go a lot, but holding fast is when we have something to say. And he that was a moment of holding fast, of giving instruction. Do not eat this. Do not eat this. In fact, people who serve me this food, like, go bury this. Go bury this so you know, no animal gets at it. Nobody gets it, right? Yeah. So I'm making a point here. I think my point here is, because we want to be feeling into the Buddha's life and relating it back to our lives, and I think we naturally do that, is that this letting go and functioning within our understanding of emptiness or of non-self, emptiness of self, does not mean that we are removed from having influence, or even removed from having a footprint. So the functionality part is knowing when to let go, when to let it be, when to stay out of it, and when to step forward, when to hold fast, when to use our influence. So I am pointing out that the Buddha did that in many instances, but in this instance with his last meal. The other thing that the Buddha did, and I imagine right away, just looking down the chain of cause and effect, I imagine he realized pretty quickly, like, this guy that served me this poison food, you know, if I say nothing, he's not going to have a good situation here. He's going to be the guy that killed the Buddha. This is not going to have positive social consequences for him. So the Buddha made sure to say, hey, folks, by the way, the person who serves the Buddha his last meal gains, I don't remember exactly what he said, gains much merit. This is a meritorious action. And we can see how he might have highlighted these aspects of things, right? So this is someone, the person who served the meal, who, without intending to, I think that's important here, he didn't set out to kill the Buddha, allowed the Buddha to take this further step, to attain this final release of the body. So that presence of mind is another one that I like to really feel into personally. Can I have a big enough mind, a broad enough mind, a mind that is adequately not caught up in me and poor me, right? Even this person did this thing to me and now I am going to die. See a bigger picture and respond to a bigger picture. And of course, that's a challenge I give to myself, not just for the moment of death. It comes up all the time, right? Comes up all the time. And instead of walking around consumed by my wants and my desires to push thing away, my likes and my dislikes, and focusing my actions only on getting what I want and pushing away what I don't want. You know, can I walk around with a bigger picture? That, this is serving. This is serving. This is the essence of serving. My picture is bigger than me. It's bigger than me. It includes one other person at least. Hopefully at least everyone in the room. And we can challenge ourselves beyond this. In continuing our February theme, this is a reminder to spend some time with that advanced directive before next week. So the practice with the advanced directives is there's not a right answer, right, on the advanced directives. The practice with is to spend some time engaging with it. Whatever that is for you. So it might be that you fill out something, right? But you'll have a process with that. you know, wherever you are with that, or it might be reviewing something. So, but what it's going to do is it will bring us into contact with the reality of our own death, right? This isn't just something the Buddha went through, but something that is part of our lives as well. And then we'll get to do whatever work is ours to do as we push ourselves into contact, right, through doing the assignment. So please engage with that a little bit this week. And then next week, we'll have sharing on that. So when we share on that, you don't have to read anything you wrote or share your particular decisions. You can. But it's more about what you saw about yourself and where you're at, and maybe what you prefer, you know, your five wishes, if that's the format you're doing. For your death. So we'll close the talk portion by chanting the four principles of practice.